couldn't understand it, she said, a little smile tugging at the corner of her mouth. It all matched up, the name, the date of birth, the time of that nursery with the stupid twee name, Little Nippers, she said mockingly. Ugh. But then suddenly there were all these pictures from Thailand and Vietnam. And when I saw you on the driveway, I began to think I'd fucked up, that maybe I did have the wrong person. It took me a few hours to track down the real you. Must be losing my touch. Shame for you, she doesn't keep her friend list private. Or that you didn't bother to delete your Facebook profile. Fuck. So it had been as simple as that. As simple as scrolling down a list of Rowan's Facebook friends and picking out the face I had so obligingly posted up for all the world to see. How could I have been so stupid? But truthfully, it had never occurred to me that anyone would join the dots so assiduously. And I hadn't been setting out to deceive, that's the thing. That's what I tried to explain to the police. If I had really been setting up a fraudulent second life, wouldn't I have bothered to cover my tracks? Because this wasn't fraud, not really. Not in the way the police meant. It was just an accident, really. The equivalent of borrowing your friend's car while they're away. I never meant for all this to happen. The problem was, the thing I couldn't tell the police, was why I had come to Heatherbrae under an assumed name. They kept asking me and digging, and I kept floundering and trying to come up with reasons, things like Rowan's references were better than mine, which was true, and she had more experience than me, true again. I think at first they thought I must have some deep, dark professional secret, a lapsed registration or a conviction as a sex offender or something. And of course none of that was the case. And as hard as they tried to find something, there was nothing wrong with my own papers. It looked very, very bad for me. I knew that even at the time. But I kept telling myself if Rhiannon hadn't discovered why I had come here, then perhaps the police wouldn't either. But that was stupid, of course. They are the police. It's their job to dig. It took them some time. Days, maybe even weeks, I can't totally remember. The interrogation starts to run together after a while. The days blurring into each other as they picked and picked and prodded and probed. But eventually they came into the room holding a piece of paper and they were smiling like Cheshire cats while simultaneously somehow trying to look grave and professional. And I knew. I knew that they knew. And I knew that I was sunk. But that was afterwards, and I'm getting ahead of myself. I have to tell the other part. The hardest part. The part I can't quite believe, even now. And the part I can't fully explain, even to myself. I have to tell you about that night. After Rhiannon walked out, I stood for a long moment in the hallway, watching the lights of the van disappear down the drive, and trying to figure out what I should do. Should I phone Sandra? And say what? Confess? Brazen it out? I looked at my watch. It was just gone 9:30. The line from Sandra's email floated into my head. Bill is off to Dubai tonight and I'm at a client dinner, but do text if anything urgent. There was no way I could ambush her with all this in the middle of a client dinner, still less text it through. Oh, Oh, hi, Sandra. Hope all is good. FYI, Rhiannon has gone out with a strange bloke, and I applied for this job under a fake name. Speak soon. The idea would have been laughable if the whole situation hadn't been so serious. Shit. Shit. Could I email her and explain the situation properly? Maybe. Though if I were going to do that, I should really have done it earlier before Rhiannon sent that fake update. It would be even harder to explain myself now. But as I pulled the tablet towards myself, I realised I couldn't really email. That was the coward's way out. I owed her a call. To explain myself, if not face to face, then at least in person. But what the hell could I say? Shit! The bottle of wine was there on the kitchen counter like an invitation, and I poured out a glass, trying to steady my nerves. And then another, this time with a glance at the camera squatting in the corner. But I no longer cared. The shit was about to hit the fan, and soon whatever footage Sandra and Bill had on me would be the least of my worries. It was deliberate self-sabotage. I knew that really in my heart of hearts as I filled the glass for the third time. By the time there was only one glass left in the bottle, I realised the truth. I was too drunk to call Sandra now. Too drunk to do anything sensible at all, except go to bed. Up on the top landing, I stood for a long time, my hand on the rounded knob to my bedroom, summoning up the courage to enter. But I could not do it. There was a dark crack at the bottom of the door, and I had a sudden unsettling image of something loathsome and shadowy slithering out from beneath it, following me down the stairs, enveloping me in its darkness. Instead, I found myself letting my hand drop and then backing away, almost as if that dark something might indeed come after me if I turned my back. Then, at the top of the stairs, I turned resolutely and all but ran back downstairs to the warmth of the kitchen, ashamed of myself, of my own cowardice, of everything. The kitchen was cosy and bright, but when I shut my eyes, I could still smell the chilly breath of the attic air coursing out beneath my bedroom door. And as I stood, irresolute, wondering whether to make up a bed on the sofa or try to stay awake for Rhiannon's return, I could feel the throb of my finger where I had sliced it on that vile, broken doll's head. I had put a plaster over it, but the skin beneath felt fat and swollen, as if infection was setting in. Walking over to the sink, I pulled off the dressing and then jumped convulsively as there was a thud at the back door. Who is it? I called out, trying not to let my voice shake.
It's me, Jack,
the voice came from outside, muffled by the wind.
I've got the dogs.
Come in, I'm just... The door opened, letting in a gust of cold air, and I heard his footsteps in the utility room and the thud of his boots as he pulled them off and let them drop onto the mat, and the barking of the dogs as they capered around him, and he tried to hush them. At last, they settled into their baskets, and he came into the kitchen.
I don't normally walk them so late, but I got caught up. I'm surprised you're still awake. Good day.
Not really, I said. My head was swimming, and I realised afresh how drunk I was. Would Jack notice?
No.
Jack raised an eyebrow.
What happened?
I had a... Jesus, where to start? I had a bit of a run-in with Rhiannon.
What kind of a run-in?
She came back and we...
I stopped, unsure how to put this. It felt completely wrong to put the full picture to Jack before I confessed to Sandra, and I was pretty sure I would be breaking all sorts of confidentiality guidelines if I'd discussed Rhiannon's problems with someone who was not her parent. But, on the other hand, I felt that I might go crazy if I didn't confide at least some of this in another adult. And perhaps there was history here, for it was becoming clearer and clearer that not everything had been included in that big red binder. "We argued," I said at last. And I threatened to call Sandra, and she just... But I couldn't finish. "What happened?" Jack pulled out a chair and I sank into it, feeling despair wash over me again. "She's gone. She's gone out by herself with some awful, unsuitable friend. I told her not to, but she went anyway, and I don't know what to do. What to tell Sandra?"
"Look, don't worry about Rhiannon. She's a canny wee thing, pretty independent, and I highly doubt she'll come to any harm, much as Sandra and Bill might disapprove.
But what if she does? What if something happens to her and it's on my watch?"
"You're a nanny, not a jailer.
What were you supposed to do? Chain her to her bed?" "You're right," I said at last. "I know you're right. It's just... Oh, God." The words burst out of me of their own accord. "I'm so tired, Jack. I can't think. And it doesn't help that my hand hurts like a bastard every time I touch anything."
"What happened to your hand?"
I looked down at it, cradled in my lap, feeling it throb in time with my pulse. "I cut it." I didn't want to go into the hows and whys now, but the thought of that grinning, evil little face made me shudder involuntarily. Jack frowned.
"Can I take a look?"
I said nothing, just nodded and held out my hand. And he took it very gently, angling it towards the light. Very lightly, he pressed the puffy skin either side of the cut and made a face.
"It doesn't look too good, if you don't mind me saying. Did you put anything on it when you cut it?"
"Just a plaster."
"I didn't mean that. I meant antiseptic, anything like that."
"Do you think it really needs it?" He nodded.
"It's deep, and I don't like the way it's puffed up like that. Looks like it could be getting infected. Let me go and see what Sandra's got in."
He stood, pushing back his chair with a screech, and walked through to the utility room where there was a small medicine cabinet on the wall. I had found the plasters in there earlier and hadn't noticed anything like TCP or surgical spirit, just a jumble of Peppa Pig plasters and bottles of children's liquid paracetamol.
"Nothing,"
Jack said, coming back through into the kitchen.
"Or at least nothing except 6 different flavours of cowball. Come back to mine. I've got a proper first aid kit in the flat."
I can't. I straightened up, pulled my hand away, curled my injured finger to my palm, feeling it throb with pain. "I can't leave the kids."
"You're not leaving anyone," Jack said patiently. "You're right across the courtyard. You can take the baby monitor. Sandra and Bill sit out in the garden all the time in the summer. It's no different. If you hear a peep, you can be back there before they even wake up."
"Well," I said slowly. Thoughts flickered through the back of my head, their edges softened and blurred by the amount of wine I'd drunk earlier. I could ask him to bring the first aid supplies back here, couldn't I? But a little part of me... Okay, no. A big part of me... That part was curious. I wanted to go with Jack. I wanted to see inside his flat. And, to be completely truthful, Mr. Wrexham, I wanted to get out of this house.
If you really thought there was a threat, how could you leave the kids to deal with it?
It was the woman police officer who asked me that, barely trying to conceal her disgust as she asked the question. And I tried to explain. I tried to tell her how the kids had seen nothing, heard nothing. How every little bit of malevolence had seemed to be directed solely at me. I had heard the footsteps. I was the one who had read those messages. I had been kept awake night after night by the noises and the doorbells and the cold. None of the others, even Jack, had seen or heard what I had. If there was something in that house, and even now I only half believed that there could be, in spite of everything that had happened, if there was, then it was out to get me. Me and the other four nannies who had packed up and left in a hurry. And I just wanted 5 minutes out from its influence. Just 5 minutes with the baby monitor in my pocket and the tablet with its surveillance cameras under my arm. Was that too much to ask? The police officer didn't seem to buy it. She just stood, shaking her head in disbelief, her lip curled with contempt for the stupid, selfish, careless bitch sitting opposite her. But do you buy it, Mr. Wrexham? Do you understand how hard it was? Shut up there, night after night, with nothing but the sound of pacing footsteps. Do you understand why just those few yards across the courtyard seemed like both nothing at all and everything? I don't know. I'm not sure if I've managed to convince you to explain what it was like, what it was really like. All I can tell you is that I picked up the monitor and the tablet, and I followed Jack as he crossed the kitchen and held open the back door for me, shutting it behind us both. I felt the warmth of his skin as he shepherded me across the dark, uneven cobblestone courtyard to the stairs up to his flat. And I mounted the stairs after him, watching the flex and shift of his muscles under his T-shirt as he climbed. At the top, he pulled a key out of his pocket, twisted it in the lock, and then stood back to let me pass inside. Inside, I expected Jack to fumble for a panel or pull out his phone, but instead he reached out, flicked something, and as the lights came on, I saw a perfectly ordinary light switch made of white plastic. The relief was so absurd and so great that I almost laughed. Don't you have a control panel?
No, thank God. These were designed as staff accommodation. No point in wasting technology on the likes of us.
I suppose so.
He flicked on another light, and I saw a small, bright sitting room furnished with good basics and a faded cotton sofa. The remains of a log fire smouldered in the little stove in the corner, and I could see a kitchenette on the far side. Beyond was another door that I supposed was his bedroom, but it didn't seem polite to ask.
"Right, sit here," he said, pointing at the sofa, "and I'll be back with a proper dressing for that cut."
I nodded, grateful for the sense of being taken care of, but mostly just content to sit there, feeling the warmth of the fire on my face and the reassuringly cheap and cheerful IKEA cushions at my back, while Jack rummaged in the kitchen cupboards behind me. The sofa was exactly like the one Rowan and I had back in our flat in London, Ektorp, it was called, or something like that. It had been Rowan's mum's before she handed it down to us. Guaranteed to last for 10 years, with a washable cotton cover that had once been red, in Jack's case, but had faded to a slightly streaky dark pink with sun and repeated launderings. Sitting on it was like coming home. After the luxurious split personality of Heatherbrae, there was something not just refreshing, but endearing about this place. It was solidly built and all of a piece, no sudden disorientating switches from Victorian opulence to sleek futuristic technology. Everything was reassuringly homey, from the mug stains on the coffee table to the medley of photos propped on the mantelpiece. Friends and their kids, or maybe nieces and nephews. One little boy cropped up more than once, clearly a relative from the family resemblance. I felt my eyes closing, two sleep-deprived nights catching up with me. And then I heard a cough, and Jack was standing in front of me, a dressing and some disinfectant in one hand, and two glasses in the other.
"Do you want a drink?"
he asked, and I looked up, puzzled. "A drink? No, I'm fine, thanks."
"Are you sure? You might need something to take the edge off when I put this stuff on. It's going to sting. And I think there's a wee bit of glass or something still in there."
I shook my head, but he was right. It did sting like fuck. First when he dabbed it with TCP, and then again when he pushed a pair of tweezers deep inside the cut, and I felt the sickening grind of metal against glass and the sting of a forgotten shard sliding deeper into my finger. Fuck! The groan slipped out without me meaning to voice it, but Jack was grinning, holding something blood-stained up at the end of his tweezers.
"Got it! Well done! That must have hurt like a bastard."
My hand was shaking as he sat down beside me.
"You know, you stuck it out longer than the last few."
"What do you mean?"
"The last couple of nannies." "Actually, I tell a lie. Katja made it to 3 weeks, I think. But since Holly, they've come and gone like butterflies."
"Who was Holly?"
"She was the first one. The one who stayed the longest. Looked after Maddie and Ellie when they were wee. And she stayed for nearly 3 years until..."
He stopped, seeming to think better of what he had been about to say.
"Well, never mind that. And number two, Lauren, she stayed nearly 8 months, but the one after her didn't last a week. And the one before Katja, Maya, her name was, she left the first night."
"The first night? What happened?"
"She called a taxi, left in the middle of the night. Left half her things, too. Sandra had to send them on."
"I don't mean that. I mean, what happened to make her leave?"
"Oh, well, that I don't really know. I always thought..."
He flushed, the back of his neck staining red as he looked down at his empty glass. "Go on," I prompted, and he shook his head as if angry at himself.
"Fuck it. I said I wouldn't do this."
"Do what?"
"I don't badmouth my employers, Rowan. I told you that on the first day."
The name gave me a guilty jolt, a reminder of all that I was concealing from him. But I pushed the thought aside, too intent on what he had been about to say to worry about my own secret. Suddenly, I had to know what had driven them away, those other girls, my predecessors. What had set them running? "Jack, listen," I said. I hesitated, then put a hand on his arm. "It's not disloyalty. I'm their employee too, remember? We're colleagues. You're not shooting your mouth off to an outsider. You're allowed to talk about work stuff to a colleague. It's what keeps you sane."
"I?"
He looked up from his contemplation of the whiskey glass and gave me a little wry smile, rather bitter.
Is that so? Well, I've said half of it already, so I might as well tell you the whole lot. You've maybe a right to know anyway. I always thought what scared them off...
He took a breath, as if steeling himself to do something unpleasant.
I thought it was maybe... Bill.
Bill?
It was not the answer I had been expecting.
In what way?
But the words were no sooner out of my mouth than I knew. I remembered his behaviour on my own first night. The spread thighs. The persistent offerings of wine. His knee insinuating itself unwanted between my own.
Shit, I said.
No, you don't need to say. I can imagine.
She was on the young side, Jack said reluctantly, and very pretty. And it crossed my mind that maybe he'd, come on to her, and she'd not known what to do. I'd wondered before. Bill had a black eye one time when Lauren was here, and I did think maybe she'd,
belted him one.
Aye, and if she did, he must have deserved it, or she'd have been sacked,
I guess.
Jesus, why didn't you tell me?
Bit hard to say. Why, by the by, my boss is a wee bit of a perv, Difficult to bring it up on a first day.
I can see that. Fuck. My cheeks felt as flushed as Jack's, though in my case it was more than half wine.
God.
Oh, yuck.
The sense of betrayal was out of all proportion. I knew that. It wasn't like I hadn't known. He'd tried it on with me after all. But somehow the idea that he'd been systematically preying on his daughter's carers time after time, careless of the fact that he was helping to drive them away, I suddenly felt a desperate urge to wash myself. Scrub all traces of him off my skin, even though I'd not seen him for days, and when I had, he'd barely touched me.
Ellie's voice filtered through my head, her reedy little treble. I like it better when he's gone. He makes them do things they don't want to do.
Was it possible she had been talking about her own father? Predating the young women and girls his wife had picked out to look after his children?
Jesus, I put my face in my hands.
The absolute fucker.
Listen, Jack sounded uncomfortable. I could be wrong. I don't have any proof of this. It's just
you don't need proof, I said wretchedly. He tried it on with me the first night.
What?
Yep. Nothing. I swallowed, gritting my teeth. Nothing I'd get very far with at an employment tribunal, all vague remarks and accidentally blocking my way, but I know when I'm being harassed.
Jesus, God, Rowan, I'm so sorry. I'm just...
It's not your fault. Don't apologise.
I should have bloody said something. No wonder you've been a bag of nerves, hearing blokes creeping about in...
No, I said forcefully. That's nothing to do with it. Jack, I'm a grown woman. I've been hit on before. It's nothing I couldn't handle. The attic stuff is completely unrelated. This is... It's something else.
It's fucking disgusting, is what it is.
His cheeks were flushed, and he stood as if unable to contain his anger while sitting still. He paced to the window, then back, his fists clenched.
I'd like to...
Jack, leave it. I said urgently.
I stood up too and put my hand on his arm, pulling him round to face me, and then...
God, I don't even know how it happened.
I don't have the words for it without writing it like a trashy novel.
Melting into each other's arms, lips coming together like a crash of waves. All those stupid clichés.
Except there was no melting, no softness. It was hard and fast and urgent and more than a little painful in its intensity. I was kissing and being kissed, and then I was biting, my own skin between his teeth too, and then my fingers were in his hair and his hands were fumbling my buttons, and then it was skin against skin and lips against lips and...
I can't write this to you. I can't write this, but I can't stop remembering it. I don't know how to stop.
Afterwards, we lay in each other's arms in front of the wood fire, our skin slicked with sweat and stickiness, and he fell asleep, his head on my breast, rising and falling gently with every breath I took. For a while, I just watched him, the way his skin paled to milk white below his hips, the brush of freckles on the bridge of his nose, the dark sweep of his lashes on his cheeks, the curl of his hand around my shoulder. And then I looked up to the mantelpiece above us both, where the baby monitor sat silently waiting. I could not go back, and yet I had to. At last, when I could feel I was beginning to slip into sleep myself, I knew that I had to get up, or risk lying here all night, and waking to find the girls making their own breakfast while I conducted a chilly walk of shame back to the main house in the dawn light. And there was Rhiannon, too. I couldn't take the chance of her finding me here when she did come back from wherever she was. I had enough explaining to Sandra to do already without adding nighttime walks to the agenda. Because I had to fess up to her. That was the only possibility. I had realised that as I lay in Jack's arms. Maybe I had even known before. I had to fess up to everything and risk losing the job. If she sacked me, I couldn't blame her. And in spite of everything, in spite of the financial hole I would find myself in with no job and no money and no references, in spite of all that, I would just have to suck it up. Because I deserved it. But if I explained... if I really explained why I had done what I'd done, then maybe... just maybe. I had my jeans almost on when I heard the noise. It was not over the baby monitor, but it came from somewhere outside the house. A noise halfway between a crack and a thud, as if a branch had fallen from a tree. I stopped, holding my breath, listening. But there were no more sounds and no squawking wail from the baby monitor to indicate that whatever it was had woken Petra and the others. Still, I pulled out my phone and checked the app. The camera icon marked Petra's room showed her flung on her back with her usual abandon, the picture pixelated and ill-defined in the soft glow from the nightlight, but the shape was clear. As I watched, she sighed and stuck her thumb in her mouth. The camera in the girls' room showed nothing at all. I'd forgotten to switch their nightlight on when I tucked them in, and the resolution was too poor to show anything except grainy black, punctuated by the occasional grey speckle of interference. But if they'd woken up, they would have switched on the bedside light, so the absence was good news. Shaking my head, I buttoned up my jeans, pulled my T-shirt over my head, and then bent and very softly kissed Jack on the cheek. He said nothing, just rolled over, and murmured something indistinct that might have been Nightlin. For a moment my heart stilled, But then I shook myself. It could have been anything. Night, love. Night, then.
And even if it was Night, Lynn, or Liz, or any other name, so what? I had a past. Maybe Jack did too. And God only knew I had too many secrets of my own to hold someone else's up to the light to condemn them. I should have just left. I should have picked up the baby monitor, walked to the door, and let myself out. But before I returned to the house, I could not resist one final look back at Jack, lying there, his skin golden in the firelight, his eyes closed, his lips parted in a way that made me want to kiss him one last time. And as I glanced back, I saw something else. It was a purple flower lying on the countertop. For a minute, I couldn't work out why it looked familiar, nor why my gaze had snagged on it. And then I realised it was the same as the flower I had found the other morning in the kitchen and put into the coffee cup to revive. Had Jack left the flower on the kitchen floor? But no, he had been away that night, running errands for Bill. Hadn't he? Or was that a different night? Lack of sleep was making the days blur, run into each other, and it was becoming hard to remember which of the long, nightmarish stretches of darkness belonged to which morning. As I stood there frowning, trying to remember, I noticed something else, something even more mundane, but something that made me stop in my tracks, my stomach lurching with unease. It was a little coil of string. Totally innocuous, so why had it unnerved me so? I walked back across the room and picked it up. It was a hank of white catering string, doubled and tripled up, and tied with a granny knot that was suddenly horribly familiar. And it had been cleanly severed, snipped in half by a very sharp knife, or perhaps the very pair of pruning shears I had rescued from the poison garden. Whichever it was, it didn't really matter now. What mattered was that it was the hank of string I had wound around the poison garden gate, too high for little hands to reach. The string I had put there to keep the girl safe. But what was it doing in Jack's kitchen? And why was it lying next to that innocent-looking flower? As I pulled out my phone and opened up Google, there was a sick, fluttering feeling in my chest, as if I already knew what I was going to find. Purple flower poisonous, I typed into the search bar, and then clicked on Google Images, and there it was. The second image, its strange, drooping shape and bright purple colour totally unmistakable. Aconitum napellus. Monk's hood, I read, the feeling of sickness growing inside me with every line. One of the most toxic flowers native to the UK. Aconitine is a potent heart and nerve toxin, and any part of the plant, including stems, leaves, petals or roots, can be deadly. Most deaths result from ingesting A. napellus, but gardeners are advised to use extreme caution in handling cuttings, as even skin contact can cause symptoms. Underneath it was a list of deaths and murders associated with the plant. I shut down the phone and turned to look at Jack, unable to believe it. Had it really been him all along? Him in the locked garden, pruning the poisonous plants, keeping that horrible place alive. Him undoing the safety measures I had set up to try to protect the children. him, carefully selecting the most poisonous blossom he could find and leaving it lying in the middle of the kitchen floor. All I had done was handle it, but it could so easily have been found by the children or even one of the dogs. And I had just fucked him. But why? Why would he do it? And what else was he responsible for? Had he been the person who hacked into the system to jolt us all out of our beds in the middle of the night with deafening music and terrified screams? Was he the one who had been setting off the doorbell, jerking me from sleep and keeping me awake with the terrifying creak, creak of stealthy footsteps? And worst of all, had he been the one who wrote those horrible things in the locked attic room and then boarded up after himself only to rediscover it when the time was right? I found that my breath was coming quick and short, my hands shaking as I shoved the phone back into my pocket, and suddenly I had to get out. Get away from him at all costs. Not troubling now to be silent, I flung open the door to the flat and stepped out into the night, slamming it behind me. It had started to rain again, and I ran, feeling the rain on my cheeks, the tightness in my throat, and the blurring of my eyes. The utility room door was still unlocked, and I let myself in, leaning back against the door and using my t-shirt to wipe my eyes, trying to get a hold of myself. Fuck. Fuck! What was it about me and the men in my life? Why were they such shits, all of them? As I stood there, trying to calm my gulping breath, I remembered the faint sound I'd heard before as I was dressing. The house was just as I'd left it. No sign of Rhiannon's high heels kicked off in the hallway, or handbag abandoned on the bottom step of the stairs. But I hadn't really expected that. I would have heard a car pulling up. It had probably been one of the dogs. I wiped my eyes again, peeled off my shoes, and walked slowly through to the kitchen, feeling the faint warmth of the underfloor heating striking up through the concrete. Hero and Claude were curled sleepily in their baskets, snoring quietly. They looked up as I came in, and then laid their heads wearily back down as I sat at the breakfast bar, put my head in my hands, and tried to decide what to do. I could not go to bed. No matter what Jack had said, Rhiannon was still missing, and I couldn't just forget that fact. What I should do, what I needed to do, in fact, was write an email to Sandra, a proper one, explaining everything that had happened. But there was something else I had to do first. For the more I thought about it, the more Jack's behaviour did not add up. It wasn't just the poison garden, it was everything. The way he was always hanging around when things went wrong. The fact that he seemed to have keys to every room in the house and access to parts of the home management system that he shouldn't. How had he known how to override the app that night when the music came screaming out of the speakers? How had he just happened to have a key to the locked attic door? And whatever he said, he was, after all, a Grant. What if there was some connection I was missing? Could he be some long-lost relative of Dr. Kennick Grant come back to drive the Ellencourts from his ancestral home? But no. That last what if was too much. This wasn't some 19th century peasant's revenge drama. What would Jack gain from driving the Ellencourts out of their own home? Nothing. All he'd get would be another English couple in their place. And besides, it wasn't the Ellencourts who seemed to be targeted. It was me. Because the fact was that four nannies, five if you counted Holly, had left the Ellencourts. No, not left. They had been systematically driven away one by one. And I might have believed that Bill's roving hands were responsible if it hadn't been for my own experiences in Heatherbrae House. Someone in this house, someone or something, was driving the nannies away in a deliberate and sustained campaign of persecution. I just didn't know who.
Somewhere behind my eyes, a dull, throbbing ache had begun, echoing the pain in my hand. The light-headedness from the wine I'd drunk earlier was already morphing into the beginnings of a shocking hangover. But I couldn't give way to that now. Slowly, unsteadily, I slid from the breakfast bar stool, walked over to the sink, and splashed my face, trying to wake myself up, clear my head for what I was about to do. But as I stood, water dripping from my loose hair, hands braced either side of the sink, I saw something. Something that had not been there when I left, I was sure of it. Or at least as sure as I could be, for now nothing seemed certain anymore. To the right of the sink was my almost empty wine bottle, only now it was totally empty. What should have had a glass left in it was now completely drained. And in the groove around the edge of the waste disposal unit was a single crushed berry. It could have been the remnants of a blueberry or a raspberry, mashed out of all recognition, but somehow I knew it was not. My heart was thumping as I reached very slowly into the waste disposal unit. Deep, deep into the metal mouth I reached, until my fingers touched something at the bottom. Something soft and hard by turns, into which my fingers sank as I clawed up the mass. It was a mush of berries. Yew, holly, cherry laurel. And in spite of the water I'd sluiced down the drain, I could smell quite clearly the dregs of wine still clinging to them. It didn't make sense. None of it made sense. Those berries had not been in the wine when I left. How could they have been? I had opened the bottle myself. Which meant someone had put them in there when I was not looking. Someone who had been in this kitchen tonight after the children were in bed. But then someone else had tipped them out. It was like there were two forces in the house, one fighting to drive me away, another to protect me. But who? Who was doing this? I didn't know. But if there were answers to be found, I knew where I had to look. My chest was tight as I straightened up, and I groped in my jeans pocket for my inhaler and took a puff, but the tension didn't loosen, and I found my breath was coming quick and shallow as I made my way to the stairs and began to climb into the darkness. As I got closer and closer to the top landing, I couldn't help remembering the last time I had stood there, hand on the rounded knob, simply unable to go any further. Unable to face whatever watchful darkness lay behind that door. Now, though, I was beginning to suspect that whatever haunted Heatherbrae was very human. And I was determined that this time I would turn the knob, open the door, and find evidence to that effect, evidence that I could show Sandra when I told her about tonight's events. But when I got to the landing, I found I didn't need to open it at all. For my door, the door to my room, was open. And I had left it closed.
I had a clear, a crystal clear memory of standing in front of it, looking at the crack beneath it, totally unable to turn the handle. And now it stood open.
It was very cold again. Even colder than it had been that time I woke in the night, shivering to find the thermostat turned down and the air conditioning blasting out. But this time I could feel it was more than just the chill of the room. It was an actual breeze. For a moment, I felt every part of that firm resolution shrivel down like plastic in a flame, disappearing down into the core of me, melting and curling into a hard, blackened core. Where was the breeze coming from? Was it the attic door? If it was open again, in spite of the lock and the key in my pocket and in spite of Jack lying asleep in his flat across the courtyard, I thought I would scream. Then I got a hold of myself. This was insane. There was no such thing as ghosts, no such thing as haunting. There was nothing in that attic but dust and the relics of bored children 50 years dead. I walked into the room and pressed the button on the panel. Nothing happened. I tried a different square, one I was sure had made the lamps come on last night. Still nothing, though an unseen fan began to hum. For a long moment I stood in the dark, trying to figure out what to do. I could smell the cold, dusty air that blew through the attic keyhole, and I could hear something too. Not the creak, creak of before, but a low, mechanical buzzing that puzzled me. And then, out of nowhere, a sudden wave of anger washed over me. Whatever was up there, I would not let myself be scared like this. Someone, something, was trying to drive me away from Heatherbrae, and I was not giving in to it. I don't know if it was the remnants of the wine in my veins that gave me courage, or the knowledge that when I rang Sandra the next day, very likely I would be going home anyway. But I took my phone out of my pocket, switched on the torch, and strode across the bedroom to the attic door. As I did so, the buzzing sounded again. It was coming from above my head. The sound was familiar, but I couldn't put my finger on why. It sounded like a furiously angry wasp, but there was something robotic about it, a quality that did not make me think it was a living thing. I felt in my jeans pocket for the key, which was still there from yesterday, hard and unyielding against my leg, and I drew it out. Softly, very softly, I put the key into the closet door and turned it. It was stiff, but not as stiff as last time. The WD-40 had done its work, and although I felt resistance, it turned, quietly, without the screech of metal on metal it had given when Jack forced the lock. Then I set my hand to the door and opened it. The smell was just as I remembered from last time. Dank, musty, the smell of death and abandonment. But there was something up there. I could see that now, something casting a low white glow that illuminated the cobwebs the spiders had woven across the attic steps. Yet no one had been up here since Jack and me, that was plain. It was not just the key in my pocket that told me that, but the thick, unbroken webs across my path, painstakingly respun since my last passage. There was no way someone could have passed this way without disturbing them. As it was,
I was forced to step cautiously, sweeping my hand in front of my face to try to keep the clinging strands out of my eyes and mouth. What was the light? The moon shining through that tiny window? Perhaps, though it was so covered with grot, I would have been surprised. At the top of the stairs, I drew a silent breath, steeling myself. And then I stepped into the attic. I saw two things straight away. The first was that the attic was just as I had last seen it when I took a final glance back at the place before following Jack down the steps the day before. The only thing that was missing was the doll's head that had rolled out from the pile to rest in the centre of the room. That was gone. The second was that the moon was shining into the attic, and surprisingly brightly, for the window that Jack had shut, was open again. He had evidently not latched it properly, and it had blown open in the night. Striding angrily across the creaking boards, I slammed it harder than he had and fumbled in the darkness for a catch. At length I found one, a long tongue drilled with holes. It was covered in thick cobwebs, and I was forced to brush them aside with my hands, feeling the crunch of a long dead prey in the webs as I wiggled it back into place, ensuring that there was no way the window could work itself open again. At last it was secure, and I stepped back into the room, wiping my hands. The light had dimmed instantly as I shut the window, the mildewed glass shutting out everything but a thin trickle. But as I turned back to the stairs, the thin beam from my torch illuminating a narrow path across the floorboards, I noticed something else. There was another light. A fainter, bluer one this time, and it was coming from a corner of the attic opposite the window, a corner totally in shadow, a corner where no light had a right to be. My heart was thudding as I crossed the floor. Was it an opening to one of the rooms downstairs? Something else? Whatever the source of the light was, it was hidden behind a trunk, and I pulled it roughly aside, no longer trying to be quiet, for I no longer cared who found me up here. I had only one instinct, to find out what was really going on. What I saw made me draw back, astonished, and kneel down in the dust to look closer. Hidden behind the old trunk was a small pile of belongings. A book, some chocolate bar wrappers, a bracelet, a necklace, a handful of twigs and berries, wilting, yes, but by no means desiccated, and a mobile phone. It was the light from the phone that I had seen from across the attic, and as I picked it up, it buzzed again, and I realised that was the source of the odd noise I had heard earlier. It had evidently updated and was stuck in a loop of trying to turn itself back on, failing and restarting, buzzing each time. It was an old model, similar to one I'd had myself a few years ago, and I tried a trick that had sometimes worked when my own phone was dying, holding the volume up and power button simultaneously for a long press. It hung for a moment, the screen whirling, and then went black, and I pressed restart. But as I waited for it to reload, something caught my eye. A silvery glint coming from the little pile of rubbish I had pushed aside to pick up the phone. And there it was, strewn innocently across the floorboards among the rest of that pathetic pile of detritus, the light from my phone torch glinting from one of its curves. My necklace.
My heart was beating fast in my throat as I picked it up, unable to believe it. My necklace. My necklace. What was it doing here? In the darkness. I don't know how long I sat in the kitchen, my fingers wrapped around a mug of tea, letting the thin links of my necklace chain trickle through my fingers and trying to make sense of it all. I had brought the phone down too, but without a PIN code, I couldn't open it to see who it belonged to. All I could tell was that it was old, and that it appeared to be connected to the Wi-Fi, but didn't seem to have a SIM card in it. It wasn't the phone that bothered me, though. That was strange, yes, but there was something personal about finding my necklace hidden up there, amid the darkness and the rotting feathers. I should have been thinking about Rhiannon, worrying about where she was, and the argument we were bound to have when she walked through the door. I should have been thinking about Sandra, considering my options and trying to work out what to say, how to tell her the truth. I was thinking about both things, but above and below and around those thoughts were twined the links of my necklace, as I tried to figure out chronologies and timings and work out how my necklace could have disappeared inside a locked room behind a door to which the only key lay in my pocket, up a corridor sealed by 100 unbroken spiderwebs. Had it been up there before, when Jack and I first broke in? But that explained nothing. That cupboard had been boarded up for months, years. The dust traces, the thick swags of cobwebs, no one had entered via the stairs for a long, long time. And the window was barely large enough for me to get my head and shoulders through, and it looked out onto sheer slates. After I found the necklace, I had scoured every inch of the room looking for trapdoors, loft hatches, hidden doors. But there was nothing. The Victorian floorboards ran from side to side in an unbroken line. The walls gave on to nothing except for the roof tiles. And I had moved every stick of furniture, looked at every inch of the ceiling from below. Whatever else I was unsure of, I was absolutely certain that there was no way in or out apart from the flight of stairs leading up from my room. The moon was still high in the sky, but the clock above the stove had ticked through 3 and 4 a.m. when I at last heard tires on the gravel of the drive, whispered laughter outside the porch, and the sound of the front door swinging automatically open, as if someone activated the thumb padlock. The door closed stealthily as the van drove off, and I heard cautious footsteps and then a stumble. My stomach flipped, but I forced myself to stay calm. "Hello, Rhiannon." I kept my voice level, and I heard the footsteps on the hallway flags freeze. And then an exclamation of disgust as Rhiannon realised she had been busted. "Fuck!" She walked unsteadily through to the kitchen. Her makeup was halfway down her face and her tights were laddered, and she smelled strongly of some mix of sweet alcohol. There was Drambuie in there, I thought, and Malibu too, along with something else. Red Bull, perhaps? "You're drunk," I said, and she gave a nasty laugh. "Kettle Black. I can see the wine bottles in the recycling from here." I shrugged. "Fair point, but you know I can't let you get away with this, Rhiannon. I have to tell your parents. You can't just walk out like that. You're 14. What if something happened and I didn't know where you were or who you were with?"
"Okay," she said, slumping down at the kitchen island and pulling the biscuit tin towards her. "You do that Rachel, and good luck with the fallout.
It doesn't matter, I said, as she picked out a biscuit and pushed the tin away. I took a digestive too, dunking it calmly in my tea, though my hands were shaking a little beneath my careful control. I've made up my mind. I'm going to tell you, Mum. If I lose my job, so be it.
If you lose your job, she snorted derisively. If you're delusional. You're here under a fake name, probably with fake qualifications for all I know. You'll be lucky if you don't end up getting sued.
Maybe, I said, but I'll take that risk. Now get upstairs and wipe that stuff off your face.
Fuck you, she said,
through a mouthful of digestive, her words accompanied by an explosion of biscuit crumbs that spattered across my face, making me recoil, blinking and brushing fragments out of my eyes.
You little bitch!
My temper, so carefully held, was suddenly fraying fast.
What is wrong with you? What's wrong with me?
Yes, you. All of you, actually. Why do you hate me so much? What have I ever done to any of you? Do you actually want to be left here alone? Because that's what's going to happen if you keep being such a fucking bitch to the staff. What the fuck do you know about it? She spat and said,